Seventh Grade Conference, Lecture 71, Physiology 10, Continuing with the Ear. As I've said before, I'm only giving you little bits and pieces here of what the ear is all about, things that you probably won't find anywhere else, at least not brought together in this way. Some things, as a lot of what I'm going to give right now, you will want to share with the children. Some things are for you, just to be carrying in your thoughts as you teach, to once again bring this to life. The senses generally are taught in an anatomical way, almost a mechanical way, and I think they really need an infusion of life. Okay, so here are some more thoughts. We've been looking at the auricle, the outer ear. Now, we also have a tube that is going through, sometimes called the external auditory canal, and this goes from the outer ear to the eardrum. Interesting, it has a threefold structure. It also is cartilaginous in nature, but only its central sheath really is cartilaginous because where it faces us inwardly, it takes on a bony quality, and where it faces the outer world, it's lined with skin. So it has in itself remarkably a threefold quality. It also has very fine hairs within it, which filter dust, and the ear, of course, has many layers of protection from the dust because it is so wide open. It also, we might say, is already beginning to massage sounds as they come in. The raw sounds that come in from the world would just be overwhelming. They'd always be completely explosive. And we know that this is a problem today with earphones, and one will want to talk to the students about the relationship of earphones to all this. We're coming to that in a moment as we approach the eardrum. But very much we'll see this again, like villi in the intestines, these very, very fine hairs, even more highly differentiated within the ear. So there is a process of touching sound. There's a tactile quality in these fine hairs, like the whiskers on a cat. And there is also a quality of starting to ingest sounds through the surface area of these fine hairs. Also, interestingly, especially for teenagers, there's a glandular component here. Right in this tube, we have two kinds of glands in this canal. The sebaceous glands, which produce fats as they do through the rest of our body, and the ceruminous glands, which produce earwax. Wax-producing glands. Remember those beeswax crayons we were using, or maybe you're still using them right now? We also produce wax. We have a kind of inner hive within us, right in the ear. It's said, of course, that the wax has a protective function. We might think of Odysseus in grade 5 putting wax into the ears of his sailors so that they could keep rowing even while he did not give himself that protection so he could listen to the song of the sirens. So yes, there's a protectiveness there. And it is interesting that today so many people have to have their ears cleaned constantly because of the buildup of wax. It might very well be because of the proliferation of noise that we need something that's of the nature of warmth, both aspects of warmth, fat and wax, that are being secreted into this auditory canal. And then we come to the middle ear. And here, as you see in the next diagrams that you should now go on to look more carefully at that, you can move a little bit further along in the picture beyond the decibels. So now we see the eardrum round about 1337 or so. You see the eardrum, and then that leads on beyond that. So this is the tympanic membrane. It's really the guardian of the threshold of hearing. And very much like the sclera of the eye, of which you will hear and teach later, it is formed out of the skin. So it's really our skin. Our outermost self comes in so that it can continue to protect us. But the sclera is highly metamorphosed skin. It's transparent. The eardrum is less metamorphosed. It still retains the quality, the consistency of our outer skin, and the great sensitivity that the skin has in modulating the interplay of the outer and inner worlds. So the first real hearing that we're doing, not just the transmission of the raw sound into us, but the really first step in hearing, we are hearing with our skin, like the skin of an animal stretched tightly in the tympani, in the drums. And the skin, we could say, which I wish we had more time in our physiology block to talk about it. It will be taken up in the Waldorf High School. But the skin, oh my gosh, what an incredible organ that is. Or we could say it's the possibility. The skin has all of the sense organs within it in potential. All of our sense organs have some connection or other with slightly or highly metamorphosed skin. And in fact, Steiner tells us that in the distant future, our bodies, our skin, will be metamorphosed into a host of sensory organs. If you see sometimes late medieval, early Renaissance, especially Northern Renaissance paintings of angelic and archangelic beings, you will sometimes see many eyes all over their bodies. We will have many eyes and many ears all over us. So the eardrum is very, very much the beginning of this. So think about a little bit about our skin and how it acts. You know, if we are shrinking from the world in fear or pain, blood withdraws from our skin. We turn pale. We try to withdraw within the safety of our body. When we feel shame, very astral here. When we feel shame, like Eve, when we, you know, are completely embarrassed and we blush, we try to escape from our skin. We want to get out of ourselves. And that's where the blood rushes to the periphery. And instead of turning pale, we blush. The eardrum is reacting in very much the same way, because it's now through the medium of our metamorphosed blood, which is muscle. We'll be learning about that in eighth grade. The contraction of the muscles, which surround the tympanic membrane, cause it to stretch tightly. Where there's a very loud noise, it is protecting it by making it tight and taut and tense. It's protecting it from excessive vibrations, which would harm it. When there's a whisper, when there's the soft sound of a harp or a lyre playing, the muscles grow lax. The membrane is capable of the most sensitive and free movement. So we could say that our eardrum grows pale, and shrinks in response to noise. It tightens up, contracts, and it blushes. It goes out in response to the more delicate sounds. Now, there's another area right here, and we've hardly gotten into the ear yet, and you see how much is going on to take care of those sounds that are coming into us. I want to just point out something that is not on the diagram, but I do mention to the students, the nasopharynx. Ever hear of that one? It is a connective device, we could say, that connects the tympanic membrane, the eardrum, to the Eustachian tube. Now, we've already been speaking about the Eustachian tube. Here's another nice segue in relationship to the lung and the esophagus and the windpipe that has to close up when we start to eat food. So the Eustachian tube is a kind of giant causeway for the movement of three streams of air. It links the activity of the middle ear, what we're talking about now, the nose, and the larynx. Here we are back to the larynx again, which is why what we hear is immediately working on our larynx. There's a wonderful channel there, and that's this nasopharynx, which brings all of this together. We can imagine hearing without breathing, and we can imagine hearing without speech, whether it's speech we receive or speech that we give out. Now, it's said that the link of the Eustachian tube to the ear allows for a release of air pressure so that, again, the eardrum is protected even when a sound, a high decibel sound or an explosion is pressing very hard. You open your mouth and some of that is released. But once again, I would say that like all of our sensory activity, this shows us that hearing and breathing are connected. And now we have one of these wonderful interlinkings of what we are teaching in one block to what we are going to teach or have already taught in another. I mentioned when speaking about the Sistine Chapel that while Michelangelo is working on the genealogy of the Christ being, taking the whole bloodline from the Hebrew Scriptures to the New Testament in this wonderful Gabrielic way, so not far from him, Fallopio is discovering the existence of the entire human reproductive system and figuring out exactly how it works. So there's something else going on at the time of the Renaissance, a lot else, that Bartolomeo Eustachio, after whom, of course, the Eustachian tube is mentioned, who understood its role, its important function in the human being, while he was discovering that, at the same time, his contemporary Andreas Vesalius, the great anatomist, was also working. And certainly next year, you'll want to find like a Dover edition or some other book with Vesalius's wonderful, wonderful anatomical drawings. So Vesalius, incredible observer of things. He was cleaning a skull, and as he did, a small bone fell out of the ear. This was a surprise to him. Had something broken? No, it was clearly a well-formed, though very, very tiny bone. Well, he looked further in the skull, and a second bone came out as well. And then that's all in with his astute observation. He only found two bones. And then a few years later, another Renaissance anatomist in Gracia came upon a third bone, the smallest of the three. He knew there had to be three because we are threefold in nature, of course. These are called the little bones or the ossicles, and they are the smallest bones in the body. And we're common with their names, though Steiner says they're misnomers. the malleus, the hammer, the incus, or the anvil, and the stapes, or the stirrup. So it's interesting that they got named after kind of activities, you know, deeds of will, that you need the stirrup in order to ride the horse. And you need the hammer and the anvil to be able to make shoes for the horse. So it's very interesting how it comes out of the real strong will forces of the human being, even though they're not truly accurate. Imagine if they were discovered today, what kinds of names they would be given. Undoubtedly, something out of the world of devices or automobiles, perhaps. So this is how long it took humanity to be aware that we had these little bones within us. You can imagine what an incredible discovery this was. Later on, the liquid, the minuscule, you know, fragment of a drop that is found in the innermost ear, this was only discovered. It was theorized that it was there, but it was discovered when another Italian anatomist put the bone out on one of those rare days in Italy when there was a frost. And the liquid, of course, expanded within the bone. It shattered it, and there they could see the frozen liquid. So it really took a long time for the anatomy of the ear to become fully known because it is so miniature. We'll go on further into the innermost sanctum of the ear in our next lecture.